Well, good evening and welcome to the first presentation in this, our 12th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the pink back there, Peggy Wright, with help from our webmaster taking pictures, Haiwan Wan, and our reference coordinator, Brian Carson. Christopher McConnell and Daniel Peach designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Daniel Pauling. Our speaker tonight is a native of Venice, California, where her family has lived since the 1960s. Growing up, she says she wanted to be a veterinarian, but she was most influenced, she said later, by feminism, Marxism, and the social studies of science. She attended the University of California at Santa Cruz, where she studied anthropology, before enrolling in the graduate program at the New School for Social Research in New York City. In 2005, she received her PhD for research on tuberculosis and healthcare reforms in post-Soviet Georgia. Prior to joining the University of Kentucky Department of Anthropology, she taught at Middlebury College in Vermont. She teaches courses on medical anthropology and global health, among others, and was recently honored with the 2011 Great Teacher Award at the University of Kentucky by the UK Alumni Association. Her interest in the Republic of Georgia dates from 1995, and she first visited the country in 2000 and has returned almost every year since then. She's currently a principal investigator on a collaborative project about the health effects of displacement of populations in light of the civil wars in Georgia. She's received numerous grants and fellowships, is widely published, and is at work on a new book on free market tuberculosis, managing medicine in the Republic of Georgia. Please welcome Professor Aaron Koch from the University of Kentucky. Aaron.
Thank you so much for inviting me. This is a really great series, and I'm happy to have the opportunity to share my work as a medical anthropologist in Georgia with all of you. I'm going to start out by talking a little bit how I became interested in the region, and then provide a little bit of historical context about Georgia, just to put things in a slightly bigger picture. And then from there, I'll spend the rest of the talk speaking about my research on displaced populations and health, drawing primarily on interview materials with Civil War victims. So I was first drawn to the Caucasus region by looking at a map. During my last year in college at Santa Cruz, I took an anthropology seminar on ethnicity and nationalism. And participants in the seminar were involved with projects that involved group and individual components. And I was part of a group looking at the former Soviet Union. And looking at a map, not unlike this one, I was drawn to the South Caucasus region, in part because I was compelled by the geopolitical location and by the just incredible diversity of boundaries that are encapsulated in a relatively small terrain. So that semester, I did research about Armenian nationalism, and my second year in graduate school, I decided to pursue PhD work there. And I had applied for a summer language program in Armenian that was ultimately canceled because only one other person had applied to study Armenian that summer. So I went back to the map and started looking into Georgia. And I quickly became very fascinated with the history, the culture, the landscape, the food. And to my surprise, I found a summer language course for Georgian that year. And there were only two of us in the class, but they ran the class anyway, which was very generous. So Georgia and the South Caucasus remain fairly understudied, even among anthropologists who work in the former Soviet Union. And as an anthropologist, rather than looking at the transition from socialism to capitalism as if it's a linear, straightforward process. From a top-down perspective, I look at the effects of social and political and economic upheaval from the ground up, from the perspectives of the peoples whose lives that are affected by these transitions, particularly through the lens of healthcare. And as Brian said, my first project looked at responses to tuberculosis in Georgia. And then the second, smaller project, for which I just finished research this summer, looks at the health effects of displacement among ethnic Georgians who were displaced from Abkhazia, which is this sort of breakaway region right here, in a 1993 civil war. And I want to just give a little history to highlight how questions of national integrity and territory have become so integral to Georgian politics and cultural consciousness over centuries, and how Georgia is has a very deep history of struggling to maintain integrity over this area in the face of trying to hold on to these two breakaway regions, which now are controlled by Russia. Okay, so first, some historical background. So Georgian history dates back as far back as ancient Greece, when what is now Georgia was two kingdoms of Colchis and Iberia. This is Colchis and this is Iberia. This is the Black Sea and then this is the Caspian over here. In Greek mythology, Colchis was the home of Medea, daughter of King Aeetes, who possessed the Golden Fleece. And some of you might know the story of Jason and the Argonauts, who traveled to Colchis to steal the Golden Fleece. And as a defense, Medea created poisons as a revenge against that act, and her concoctions are believed to be the origins of modern medicine, of modern pharmaceuticals. And it's important to note that this is not just kind of ancient history, but that Georgians have a very strong, deeply rooted historical consciousness, and it's typical in any conversation about Georgian history or Georgian medicine for people to refer to this history of Medea as being the origins of medicine. So they claim to have invented medicine. They also claim to have invented wine. Georgian history is marked by constant struggles for independence, which often keep the country divided, but sometimes unified in struggles against empires, the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire, Byzantine, Persian, Ottoman, and so on. In the 4th century, so questions of unification are really important here. And in the 4th century AD, the Georgian alphabet was invented to spread scripture across the country. Georgia is actually one of the first Orthodox Christian countries in the world. And in the 12th century, Queen Tamar, who took over the throne from her father, King Georgi, and ruled Georgia during what's known as the Golden Age. And this was a time of peace and prosperity when warring neighbors were kept at bay. And it was also a time that witnessed tremendous growth in Georgian literature and the arts. And this is, obviously, this is the part of the Georgian script that just says Kartuli or Georgian. So now I'm going to ask you to fast forward quite a few centuries to the Soviet period. Georgia was established as a Soviet republic in 1921. And being a Soviet republic brought many benefits, but also some burdens. Despite the fact that Russian was the official language for 70 years, the Georgian language remained an important part of the country's cultural heritage, even as things like ethnic and national identity and pride were muted and discouraged by Soviet leaders. And because of the country's proximity to the Black Sea and the subtropical climate there, Georgia was a popular resort destination for Soviet elites. So the country produced wine, tea, citrus, and other agricultural products for the rest of the Soviet Union. And the location where I've done my research with the displaced populations is right here in this town called Zudidi, and it's very, very close to Abkhazia. And Georgia's transition from the Soviet Union was marked by quite a bit of turmoil and violence. On April 9th, 1989, during a demonstration outside of the parliament in the capital city, Tbilisi, Soviet troops were sent in and many people were killed by tanks and gunfire. And this event was a catalyst that further mobilized anti-communist opposition. On the heels of Lithuania, Georgia separated from the Soviet Union in 1991. And this was immediately followed by the election of the first post-Soviet president, Zviad Gamsachurdia. He was a dissident, and he was assassinated at the end of that year, sparking ethnic civil wars between Georgia and South Ossetia and Georgia and Abkhazia. So South Ossetia is right here. And then again, Abkhazia. And those are both ethnically distinct regions that were part of Georgia under the Soviet Union and are fighting against Georgia to be sovereign at this time. Shevardnadze was, in 1992, Everett Shevardnadze, who had been Minister of Foreign Affairs under the Soviet Union, returned to Georgia, and he took on a leadership role opposing Abkhaz and South Ossetian desires for sovereignty, which was heavily supported by Russia, who remained reluctant to lose control over this important geopolitical area. Shevardnadze was elected president in 1995, and this led into a really long period of economic, social, and political stagnancy in Georgia. He was re-elected in 2000, but citizens were increasingly dissatisfied with rising poverty, and his regime faced accusations of corruption in parliament, the police, and so on. And in 2003, international observers claimed that the parliamentary elections were fraudulent, and they were indeed quite fraudulent. So this further mobilized opposition against Shevardnadze's regime, led by the current president, Mikhail Saakashvili. And in October of 2003, Saakashvili and his supporters literally took over parliament and physically removed Edward Shevardnadze as president. You might have seen it on the news, in the so-called Rose Revolution. And riding on a campaign of democracy building, anti-corruption, westernization, and economic growth, Saakashvili was elected president in January of 2004. And his presidency, which is really relevant to the IDP situation, has brought about a strengthening of the military, reduced corruption, sort of, improved relations with Europe and the United States in some ways, but he also implemented a series of neoliberal reforms. Talk about neoliberalism for a second. That have led to poverty, job loss, and tremendous uncertainty. And just to be clear, neoliberalism here refers to just free market-oriented economic doctrines and sets of values that emphasize things like privatization, the withdrawal of state services and deregulation, and individualized responsibility. And there was a moment of shock therapy in the early 1990s when the Soviet Union was dismantled and Boris Yeltsin ordered a rapid loosening of state control over currency, prices of goods and trade to kind of shock the system into being able to enter global markets. These sudden changes not only shocked the economic systems they were meant to stimulate in a positive way, they also produced long and short-term shocks that reverberated through people's very daily lives. And Saakashvili has really made this kind of neoliberal reform a central part of his strategy for government restructuring. And then you all have probably heard of the August War of 2008 between Russia and Georgia. So that further weakened Georgia's political and economic situation. Georgian troops entered South Ossetia and tried to regain control of that region, and the army was completely destroyed by Russia in one fell swoop in a matter of days. And more than 120,000 ethnic Georgians living in South Ossetia had to flee into Georgia as internally displaced persons, or IDPs. And that's basically, they're similar to refugees, but they're people who have not crossed an internationally recognized boundary. Okay, so we're talking about a country that is approximately the size of Kentucky, with a population of about 4.5 million, and about 6% of that total population is made up of IDPs, internally displaced people. The majority of the people who fled South Ossetia in 2008 have been able to return, but there are estimated about 200,000 people displaced from the Civil War in 1993 from Abkhazia who remain in this kind of state of limbo. And those people are called old IDPs or Shevardnadze's IDPs, whereas the 2008 people who fled are new IDPs or Saakashvili's IDPs. And it's the old IDPs who I have been working with. Culturally and politically, there's been a lot of tension over how the new, so-called new IDPs have been treated as compared to the old ones. The early 1990s, again, were a time of tremendous upheaval in Georgia, and there was no stable government able to assist them. Government strategies to provide social services for IDPs have shifted dramatically over the past 15 to 20 years. Since Shevardnadze's government first launched an official plan for the return to Abkhazia in 1996, priorities have shifted from trying to get people to be able to return to integrating them into Georgian society. So there's a shift in thinking as to whether or not Abkhazia will ever be part of Georgia again and these people will be able to return. And with the 2003 Rose Revolution, Mikhail Saakashvili brought about a kind of new era in IDP policy, though not necessarily to the benefit of those populations. In 2004, IDPs who had been living in two very large former Soviet hotels in Tbilisi were evicted, where they had lived for over a decade, and the hotels were redeveloped for tourism and casinos, and those people were essentially displaced yet again. A subsequent strategy for IDPs that was released by the Georgian Ministry for Refugees in 2007 was outmoded by that 2008 war. And by contrast, in 2008, the government of Georgia was able to offer immediate relief to people displaced from South Ossetia, primarily because of the $4.5 billion that the country received in international aid for post-war building. So there's a lot of animosity between these two populations over the kinds of care that they're receiving from the government. And since that time, the government's designed an official action plan for implementing the state strategy regarding the IDP population. And it was launched in 2009, and it prioritizes improving their living conditions. But in practice, again, it's basically been a mechanism for re-displacing people. It's involved moving people on very short notice or no notice to locations in the country where they have no social support networks or hope for employment. And there have been a lot of protests in throughout Georgia, but primarily in the capital city at the IDP and Refugee Ministry. Protesters have expressed their angers about how they're being treated, with acts of self-immolation, of setting themselves on fire, and express the way that they see themselves in society as people who have no voice by literally sewing their mouths shut. So it's a highly, highly politicized and very public issue. So again, this is a group that makes up about 6% of the total population and whose lives are kind of caught in this long-term political stalemate. Both Abkhazia and South Ossetia are, again, supported economically, socially, and politically by Russia at this time. Both territories are occupied by the Russian army. And in 2009, Russia evicted international observers who had been monitoring both sides of the border of those territories. And so now only the Georgian sides are monitored by the European Union. At the same time, Georgia refuses to let go of these two contested territories, despite the obvious political and economic ramifications of what some people see as just kind of stubbornness by the current president. Finally, both old and new IDPs at this point are almost entirely dependent on assistance that they receive through foreign aid for things like food, medicines, clothing, household goods, and so on. And so after months, and in some cases 18 years of being displaced, people really feel that their lives have become meaningless. And I want to, for the rest of my time, share some of the insights of the IDPs that I've worked with in my fieldwork to highlight how all of these bigger political economic processes unfold on the ground. And so this is based on two summers of fieldwork in summer 2010 and 11. And I did interviews with displaced people in their residences. I did participant observation in some clinics where people seek healthcare. And I also interviewed representatives of the government, medical professionals, and people who work with NGOs and international organizations. But today I'm mainly going to draw on interviews with IDPs that focus on their life histories, on their stories with being displaced by the war, and on how they are navigating a shifting terrain of social services in Georgia to try to get access to health care. And one of the things that I'm looking at, this is a work in progress, so one of the things that I'm looking at as I continue to go through my data is how they give meaning to health, to what it means to be healthy and to what a normal life is in these ongoing transitions in the Georgian healthcare system. A collective center, it's a woman who lives in two rooms, and this is the main room of the dwelling where she lives. And I'm going to move into the sort of more anthropological material by starting out with a quote from an interview that I did with her. So this is her speaking. "A lot of us Devna Lebi have damaged health. I was sick before the war in 1993, but I became 5 times worse here. Some people who were healthy are sick. We have no support and we worry a lot. There's only a river dividing." She's referring to the river that provides the border between Georgia and Abkhazia, less than 5 kilometers from where we were speaking. "We see our home and we cannot go there. I think that is why we are getting ill, why we have heart pains. Maybe we won't be able to go back to Abkhazia at all. I want to live in normal conditions. This is what I asked the minister and the local government, but no one is listening." End quote. Thus spoke Dolly, a woman in her 50s who has been living since 1993 as an internally displaced person near Zudidi, a small city in western Georgia. In Dolly's words, she is fully disabled, not because of the rheumatoid arthritis she's developed or the physical disability that restricts her movements to a wheelchair, and not because she cannot use the wheelchair to enter her two-room dwelling in which the wooden floors are too disintegrated to support its weight, being this room, but because she is socially immobilized as an IDP. In talking with me about her personal history, her everyday life, and state services, she used the word Devna Lebi, which means persecuted ones, literally people who are being chased, to refer to IDPs rather than Lutov Lebi, refugees. She also wove together her personal traumas, living conditions, and the uncertainty that shape her daily life with the forms of governance that, in her words, keep her from living a normal life. For Dolly, the biological and social aspects of displacement are not so easily separated from each other, but they are reinforced by state policies that determine access to habitable housing, which she obviously does not have, medical services, and pensions. And a lot of IDPs who I spoke with over the course of this research draw similar connections between this very protracted long-term displacement and ongoing changes in state services for people who do or do not qualify as living under the poverty line. So there's actually IDPs in Georgia who live in conditions like this, but who don't qualify as living under the poverty line. IDPs also despair that they have not been adequately integrated as members of Georgian society. So I'm interested in how this way of life of living in protracted displacement for so long redefines meanings of well-being and care in families and communities as people try to navigate this very confusing maze of social services. And in this context, I think that poor health emerges in tension with medical and social service restructuring that's shaped by the government but also by international organizations. In Georgia and in much of the former Soviet Union, health sector reforms are unfolding in a larger and rapidly growing global health enterprise. Global health can refer to many things, such as illnesses that are literally global in their reach, primarily due to movements of people, microbes, changes in environment and diet, and shifting dynamics of poverty associated with globalization and the kind of neoliberal reforms that I was just discussing. But here I'm talking about global health really to refer to the health policy and donor field that brings together governments, funders, service providers, NGOs, and sick people in new ways. So it's really trying to look at the role of foreign assistance in this healthcare process. And in this arena, development-oriented stakeholders, the World Bank, the IMF, USAID, so on and so forth, and philanthropy organizations create competition for NGO funding in places like Georgia and create sort of competing moral claims about how people should be personally managing their health, about what it means to comply to medical directives, and what counts as proper self-care. And these are all things that are being directed at these IDP populations through different health service and social service programs. So at a time when it seems that return to Abkhazia would be impossible for many, largely because of the Russian presence, the Georgian government is suddenly paying a lot more attention to this old IDP population than they have been in the past. In international eyes, this old IDP population symbolizes the failure of the government of Georgia to socially integrate them and to operate in acceptable parameters of human rights. So there's accusations of human rights abuses going on here. And as a result, Georgia is not seen as fit for membership in the EU or in NATO or things like that, to which the current government has extremely high aspirations. And in this setting, the government is sort of using these human rights interventions to present a better picture of itself. But the assistance is not actually reaching people on the ground. And so that's what I'm trying to understand from the perspective of the IDPs and from the perspective of NGO workers. The so-called old IDPs in Zudidi are dispersed throughout the area in collective centers or private accommodations. 42% of them live in collective centers, and this is an example of a collective center. They're basically private or government-owned buildings that were offered to IDPs in 1993 as emergency short-term housing when they crossed into the border. And the picture of me that is on your blog that I sent to Brian is of me at a point where they crossed the border. Okay, so that's what that picture is. Housing like this was never meant to house people long-term. Most of them are former kindergartens, partially or non-functioning hospitals, former factories or other sites of Soviet production that are not equipped for heating, cooking, don't have running water. The conditions are really dilapidated and unsanitary, if not inhumane. And so the living conditions, the everyday basic living conditions, is one of the things that has affected people's health so dramatically. The main health problems that afflict this population are psychological distress, dermatological conditions such as lice, gastrointestinal diseases because of a lack of sanitation and clean water, goiter and stress-related conditions such as hypertension. One set of problems that run through a lot of my conversations with IDPs, and I'm going to speak a little Georgian now, are gulis avad makopo, which means heart sickness, and gulis tkliva, which means heart pain. And in talking with IDPs, it's not clear to me whether they're referring to cardiological problems, physiological problems, or heart sickness as in an affective state. And perhaps the bureaucratic and living conditions of protracted displacement blur this distinction for them. And perhaps because the word heart is a significant cultural idiom in Georgian language, this is not so surprising. So this is just, force you to look at Georgian a little bit. The word guli, heart, which is, you can see that it's this first few G-U-L-I letters. The word guli, heart, expresses things in Georgian ranging from parts of the body to temperaments, to states of being and attitude. The word for candid is gulits pleli, and gul grili, gray heart, means indifferent. And there's a whole range of words that encapsulate guli as a way of expressing emotion, expressing kindness, anger, meanness, indifference, all of these kinds of things. And during my conversations with displaced people, a lot of them wove together concerns that reflected on lives lived in this very strange state of limbo. Long-term displacement catches them between immobility on the one hand, literal physical immobility, and these cycles of bureaucratic upheaval and uncertainty on the other. A lack of trust in the government and fears of learning about health conditions that they might not be able to afford the treatments for, or that might orphan their children, discourage people from seeking medical care. And many are even reluctant to seek services at a clinic in Zudidi that is specifically meant to be for IDPs and where officially registered IDPs can receive low-cost medical care even if they don't have private or state-financed insurance. Others live beyond the city limits and can't afford to get to the clinic. So I want to talk about one other woman as an example. Tamuna is in her mid-50s. She has warm brown eyes and a cheerful smile when she offers one, but she also exudes a deep sadness with her demeanor. She carries herself as if she is a sigh, not of release, but of loss. She fled Abkhazia in 1993 and has been living in the same single room in a collective center with her two children since then. And that's the outside of the building. They live on the second floor, and the third floor is a functioning hospital, actually. Their room, which is no bigger than 10 by 15 feet, is on the second floor, where a total of 13 families currently reside. That's the floor that they live on. It has communal bathrooms, but no running water, and precarious electricity at best. Although the residents go to great pains to keep their personal spaces clean, many of the 1 to 3 room quarters have broken or empty windows, severely cracked and crumbling walls, ceilings that leak when it rains, and mold and dust that reside there as permanently as the IDPs do. In describing her everyday life to me, Tamuna said, quote, "My life is hard. It's hard for me to live here. It's the 18th year that I'm here, and it's very difficult for me. You see the conditions of ours. We sleep in cut beds," meaning they have to cut up mattresses to everybody get a piece, "all three of us, me and my two children. I am sick myself. I have neurosis. I have pain in my heart. I have to have a surgery done, heart surgery, and I don't have enough money to buy medicines. My condition is bad. My kids study well. One loves football, but I don't have enough money to pay for his travel to go to practice. I'm so sorry I cannot help my children. I raised both of them, and my condition is very bad because of my health. I have pain in the heart, and I need surgery immediately. But I don't have a policy, a health policy. I applied again, but the man came, one guy, and I did not have the IDs of my children. They lost them at school." And she goes on to talk about how difficult it is to get replacements because you have to go to the capital city, which is an expensive day-long trip, and so on and so forth. So a bit later in our conversation, a Georgian doctor who was affiliated with an NGO that was doing outreach to them and who helped introduce me to IDPs joined the conversation. So Nino is the doctor, and she said, "So you went to the doctors for consultation. Did you pay for it?" Tamuna says, "Yes, that's because I don't have the policy. It's 10 days since I got the prescription, and I have it, but I can't buy the drugs." So Ninos asks her if she asked anyone to help her, like a brother, a relative, or a friend. And Tamuna said, "Well, all of them have financial problems, and to help just once or twice does not make a big difference." A few minutes later, without any real prompting, Tamuna returns to the topic of her children. And she says, "What kind of childhood could they have? Excuse me for saying this, but my son is already 18, and he has not seen what a normal bathroom is like or what a normal apartment is like. I saw everything. We had everything in Abkhazia then. We were not millionaires, but we had everything necessary for life. Now we have nothing, so what could the children see? Nothing. So I cry when the children are not home, then I wash my face and meet them cheerful, as if everything was okay. I am like that. I have to have heart surgery." At this point, Nino, the doctor, asked her when she had received the diagnosis of a heart problem. Tamuna told us that she had found out that she needed immediate surgery for her heart pains 9 years ago, in 2001. Nino suggested that perhaps she does not have cardiological problems, but nervousness and depression. Tamuna agreed and said, quote, "I'm afraid of everything. I worry about everything. I think about the worst all the time." And Nino, who was already familiar with her health history, asked if she was still having stomach pains. Tamuna replied, "Yes, I do. I have pain in my heart, and that's when I have to urinate, but I can't get up because I'm afraid not to have a heart attack. Then I have a stomach ache, and then I have the pain in the heart, and that's why I take medicine." As our conversation proceeded, we asked her whether she'd sought psychological services. She told us that she had, but that the main advice she received, in addition to anti-anxiety medical prescription, was that, quote, "I am the doctor of myself, that I have to be the doctor of myself now. The doctor said I should think of positive things, of my children, so I take the broom and I sweep the house, and that calms me down." And that conversation with Tamuna was really typical to those that I had with other people displaced by this war in 1993. And it wasn't just the content that was similar, but the way that the conversation unfolded and that she sort of combined all of these topics together in what sounds like a rather chaotic fashion. Really reflects the ways in which, for them, it's difficult to separate all of these problems from each other. And so it kind of reflects this conundrum that they're in of being immobile on the one hand, but constantly caught in these changing state policies and foreign assistance programs on the other. Tamina receives a monthly allowance of 22 Georgian lari, which is about $12.50, because she lives in a collective center that's owned by the government. And this is where the sort of messiness of their situation becomes even clearer. This is less than the allowance she would receive if she qualified as quote-unquote socially vulnerable or living under the poverty line, which would automatically give her state health insurance. She used to have, you know, mediocre health care through a state-funded policy that was just for IDPs, but that policy was canceled in 2007 after the Georgian government, the Social Services Agency, began its targeted assistance program for socially vulnerable populations. And this is similar to trying to get welfare here, very, very similar. It's actually modeled a lot on the US system. Since then, the SSA, Social Services Agency, conducts assessments of individuals and households throughout the country that apply for different kinds of allowances from the state. Under the program, people can receive monthly allowances if they qualify as disabled, if they're veterans of war, or families of soldiers who died in combat, pensioners, and so on. And again, the benefits range from 22 lari, or about $12, to several hundred lari a month, depending on what category you qualify for. And the assessment involves a really invasive scoring process, whereby the mere fact of employment, irrespective of salary, or possessing a television or even a refrigerator in your home might increase the points that you're scored and reduce your likelihood of getting any assistance from the state. So these are people living in total abandonment. To qualify for state medical benefits, which is what they call the policy, you have to be scored 70,000 points or less. And a lot of IDPs living in conditions like these don't have the policy, and they're confused as to whether or not they can also take an allowance for living under the poverty line and the IDP allowance and all these other things. And part of the problem is that the policies are changing all the time, but no one tells them when things have changed. So there's a big lack of information here. And for NGO workers who are trying to help them, this kind of confusion and lack of information is a really serious obstacle to trying to improve people's lives. I want to talk about an NGO worker I spoke with. I call her Annika, and she worked for a European NGO that was involved with a long-term project to bring social work to IDPs by training and project funding. So they were trying to bring the institution of Western social work to Georgia, and they were trying to train mainly Georgian employees so that people would feel more comfortable in working with the social workers. The international organization lost its funding and had to abruptly stop their program, so now those services are gone. But they were trying to help IDPs at both individual and community levels in determining their needs, helping them secure the kind of documentation that they need to get benefits, helping them learn how to advocate for their own medical and legal rights, to housing, education, and so on and so forth. And when I interviewed this woman, Annika, I asked her about some of the obstacles that they face in as social workers. And she identified a handful of concerns about access to information, about what she called IDP mentalities, and about trying to teach people about the Western profession of social work, which is very foreign in the former Soviet context. Lack of information is a serious obstacle, she said. People don't know when their place will be rehabilitated at all. They don't know if they should petition the government for this information or an NGO, because some international NGOs are coming and rehabilitating some places. Often the government, the local government, does not know if a building is supposed to be rehabilitated or who's responsible for it. So as foreign assistance continues to flow into countries that formerly comprised the Soviet Union, local governments are adopting these neoliberal free market worldviews and shrinking social services. For Annika, this aspect of the reforms is really frustrating. She said, quote, "When we go to the higher levels of the government, they perpetuate the idea that international organizations are primarily responsible for implementing the IDP action plan and other things. They very often ignore us and don't respond to our requests. They feel that we're bothering them, although we're basically demanding from them that they fulfill their responsibilities and implement what they are supposed to do. And very often, government representatives try to push their tasks on us. They tell IDPs, go ask that NGO or the other NGO, but it's not our task to provide the community with things that the government is supposed to supply. Another obstacle to helping IDPs help themselves is what a lot of people on the ground refer to, again, as this IDP mentality of passivity. So there's a general sense that IDPs are being passive and they're not doing enough to help themselves, but that worldview doesn't take their actual situation very well into consideration. And for Annika, this is a really touchy subject. When I spoke with her, she struggled to find the words to describe this kind of mentality without adopting an attitude that would blame the victims. She said, I don't know, lack of, I don't know, motivation maybe? They somehow agreed on such a life and they don't really feel the need to improve anything. I face this problem a lot of times. I have the feeling when I'm trying to, when I'm interviewing or talking with our beneficiaries and I'm trying to show them new ways or what the future could somehow look like, I don't really feel that we understand each other. And I don't really feel that what I'm saying is received on the other side. I think that sometimes they don't really have the need to improve anything, that somehow they got used to their situation, or I don't know. Then I think that there are not enough efforts made to inform them, especially the village and rural population. There is no proper language that is being used to contact them. Using this whole NGO vocabulary is really like using a foreign language, even translated into Georgian. We also face this a lot of times. Even the word social worker is difficult. So maybe part of the problem is lack of a common language. And here the experiences of Dolly, the first woman I quoted, as a disabled person who's been living among the worst conditions are very insightful. So this is another room in the place where Dolly lives. Dolly described her health to me in Georgian as damaged. She used that word. And she said, for me personally, as a sick person, these conditions are really bad. You have to depend on someone else and wait until they do something for you. I don't have the health problems that will qualify me for the benefits received by people in the first category of disabled person. We don't have a bathroom inside, nothing at all. The floor is totally broken. Snakes and lizards come out of there. The walls are falling apart, and the ceiling is too. They say no repair can be done here, and we were not for that either. We never wanted to live here forever, she said, angrily waving her hand at the building behind her. And as our conversation proceeded, she explained that she had been trying to advocate for her rights to better housing, and that this building back here is the building that they live in, and this is just a sign of international organizations on site. She explained that she'd been trying to advocate for her rights to better housing and to better health benefits for years through proper channels, rather than, for example, trying to bribe people, and that was an example that she gave of other routes people take to get things done. But she also spoke with an air of defeat, and she said, quote, I don't sleep well, and I have some problems with nerves. There is nothing to hide. Our nerves are as bad as our petrol. I could stand so much before, but everything has to end. This type of life, this illness, everything. I remember I would not sleep for nights and sat with my eyes open. And at this point, Marina, a social worker who was working with me and who introduced me to Dolly, chimed in and we asked her if she had contacted the local government lately. And I asked her, do you know what your rights are? And she replied, I don't know. They don't do anything that we ask for. So I don't know what the rights are. I think they took all the rights away from us. Marina, who's an optimist, said, no, no, you truly have the right to ask for an apartment in the social houses that are being built, trying to encourage her that the rights for IDPs are actually being put into practice and not merely words on paper. But Dolly's experience as someone whose health is damaged, to use her word, and as someone who's been going through these processes for almost two decades, and whose health is perhaps not quite damaged enough, trumped everything else. And she said, yes, I went to the government office, and as I said that I'm sick and I have a right to better housing. The man shouted at me saying he has an IDP who's sicker than me, and he gave him that apartment. So I kind of want to end on that note and just a couple of closing remarks. So again, population is caught in a tension between social immobility and shifting cycles of bureaucratic upheaval and uncertainty. And people like Dali and Tamuna, when you listen to them tell their stories of their daily lives, suggest that protracted displacement, deplorable living conditions, loss of hope, and frustration over and confusion over changing social services blurs the distinction between emotional heartache and being physiologically sick. And I think that one thing that we can learn from people like them is that the health effects of displacement are not purely biological outcomes of living in this kind of housing or lack of access to medical service, but being poor and having poor health emerges in tension with medical and social structuring, social restructuring in Georgia, places like Georgia. And the examples that I've given here of how IDPs are trying to learn how to navigate this shifting terrain of assistance programs that have the potential to alleviate illnesses really tell us, I think, a lot about the effects of post-Soviet democratization and neoliberal reforms from the ground up. And I think that it's critical to understand how people give meaning to these processes in their daily lives. I think that anthropological studies can have a lot to offer in this regard, giving voice to people who are usually invisible or silenced within and by the aid apparatus that aims to help them is one thing that anthropology can do. I think if we try to understand things from people's perspectives, we can also rethink some of the categories of analysis that we use and that's used in the policy world. So understanding the everyday lives of IDPs, the effects of displacement on their well-being, and the social and structural factors that shape the decisions that they make and that, you know, lead to people saying that they have a passive mentality can provide important local knowledge that's often eclipsed in research that only focuses on macro level processes. What anthropology tried to do. So that's it.
Questions?
What is the ethnicity of these people? Is it Russian? Is it Georgian? Is it different from the other 90-something% of the population?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. The IDPs who I'm working with and who were fled Abkhazia in 1993 are mainly ethnic Georgians who had been living in Abkhazia when it was just Soviet Georgia and who had to flee for their safety during that civil war. They're the same ethnicity as the rest of the population who are Georgian, but Georgia is, one of the things that's interesting about Georgia is the kind of cosmopolitanism. So there's Armenians, Azeri, Russians, South Ossetians, Abkhazians all live in the country. But the IDPs are primarily Georgian.
I was wondering what it was that prevented them from getting a job. Is it they don't have the right documents?
A lot of it has to do with they lost their documents in the war and were not able to get them replaced. A lot of it has to do with the simple fact that in part because of a lot of the government restructuring, especially with the current president, unemployment rates have skyrocketed, so there's not a lot of work for a lot of people. And I think some of it is holding on to this really profound desire and hope that one day they will be able to return home. A lot of them still have land in Abkhazia. A lot of them left, sort of vast orchards and agricultural land that they had been working on and their families had been working on. And so I think part of it is I hope that they'll be able to return someday.
And what is stopping them?
Russian border guards.
So Russia doesn't want them there.
It's a complicated and changing situation. There's a current process that's going on right now, and it might change again, whereby they can go back, but they have to adopt a Russian passport and not be Georgian anymore, and they can't come back to Georgia to live. So there's a big sacrifice involved, and it's because they've been living there for 20 years, they've had kids, their kids are in school, they have social networks, and so to just pick up and leave again It's a really big decision. Yeah. That's a great question.
Do you see any similarities between the people you're studying and for example, Palestinians in Palestinian camps of long standing?
I think that probably just the experience of living in that kind of
internal displacement.
Yeah, limbo for so long is similar. One difference with this population is that, again, you know, a lot of them live, they're not living in camps, so they don't live in that kind of concentrated, stereotypical refugee environment that we think of. They live dispersed all around the community, and that means that the social networks that they create to try to sort of deal with their living situation is very different than, I think, what happens. I don't know if that's what you're asking about, but yeah.
Is there any industry that would keep the, or give, or infuse in the younger generations some hope so that they would not wind up in this manner?
Yeah, and I mean, and a lot of that, there isn't an industry. But a lot of families really try to instill that in their children and encourage them to be educated. There's one thing that's going on in the country right now, which is not directly related to this situation, but in terms of education, there's a huge program, it's huge, to teach English in absolutely every single school in the entire country. So there's, I think, about 10,000 English teachers in this tiny country right now. And the government is using that as a way to sort of promote the idea that that's an avenue for bettering things in the future. And there's a lot of concerns about it because of the way it's being done and the question of whether sort of, you know, knowing English in rural Georgia is really going to help you have a better future. But in terms of industry, not really that I know of at the moment. Most of the sort of hope generating comes from the families and their communities.
Would they ever earn a living when they are younger
now? The parents or the children?
Anybody. It seems as if as they get older, there is just nothing there, but is there anything to give hope?
People have hope. A lot of it comes from their memories of the past.
But it doesn't bring water. Hope doesn't bring water to your apartment.
No. I don't have a good answer for your question. It's a great question. It's just people struggle. It's a life in struggle, really. So some people are employed. It's not a completely unemployed population. There's a variety, but a lot of people don't have hope for the future, unfortunately, and that's a really sad reality.
To what extent do you think that Georgians have become realize that a lot of their problems are their political leadership? I mean, Shevardnadze obviously was such a great statesman, but I think, in my opinion, what Georgia tried to do was maybe get too close to the West. Even, I mean, it doesn't have, I don't think it has a lot of natural resources. It was never a really rich country, but they've gone downhill. There's HDI or UNDP, I think, showed up as poorer and poorer, and so by, I don't know, tangling with the Russian bear, I mean, it seems such a like dumb idea, but they continue to, I mean, nationalism and hyper-nationalism and just stoking that, I think, is a lot of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't help when you have internally displaced people to it, but they're fired up as well.
Yeah.
So how they realize that? Or are they still kind of just out? The most recent report is that the EU essentially, they completely blame Georgia, but essentially Georgia came out on being at fault for starting this war,
mm-hmm.
more so than Russia did. And I think we were on the wrong side, at least our politicians were, by, I think, encouraging the government there to make these mistakes even.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's a great question, and I think that you know, immediately following the Rose Revolution, and, you know, I've been going there since 2000, so I've sort of seen a lot of these shifts happen. You know, people were so fed up with Shevardnadze. When Saakashvili came in, it was like a cloud lifted. But over the years, people started sort of becoming skeptical, and I think that 2008 war was really a catalyst for causing people to question the government and whether or not the government actually has the best interests of the country at heart, and whether or not trying to so stubbornly hang on to these territories is a good idea. A lot of the people who I speak with do agree that the Georgian government started this war, and that they were crazy to, it's not just that that the United States sort of encouraged it in certain ways, but Saakashvili really thought that the United States, I mean, he thought that the United States Army was going to come in and fight the Russian Army for Georgia, and that was absurd. Right, exactly. Exactly. So I think that after that happened and people seeing sort of how it unfolded politically and then what the ramifications were for the country, that really caused a change of tides in how people see the government. You know? So people are not happy.
So then they don't like Russia?
Some people do, but, you know, not everybody. There's definitely very, very strong anti-Russian sentiments.
When you go over there, do you go strictly in a research capacity, or so you don't provide information or connect with the services to?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have to be careful, sort of for ethical reasons. But so I usually go strictly in a research capacity. But what I try to do is, so for example, after I finish analyzing my data, I'm going to write a report for the EU monitoring mission that's over there working with IDPs about the IDP perspectives that I learned about in terms of what their obstacles are. And so I don't directly try to connect them with services, but I try to find ways to use the anthropological insights to kind of get that perspective out to some of the organizations.
You said nothing about tuberculosis. Is that an endemic problem in this region, or?
You know, yes.
It is.
It's an endemic problem actually in the world right now. Yeah. And it's, you know, in Georgia, part of it is part of what else is going on in the country, in addition to this kind of dropping in poverty and everything, increasing poverty, is. Saakashvili has launched a war on crime that is modeled on greatly the U.S. prison system. And as of the end of 2010, Georgia has the sixth highest per capita prison population in the world. And tuberculosis is a big part of that. So it's quite alarming. Yeah, and it's part of this question that you were asking about, right? So kind of the local Muslim threat, or yeah, I think that's part of it. Also part of it is, sorry, I don't mean to do this, it's kind of annoying, but this is really valuable port territory. So that's, you know, one of the reasons why Abkhazia occupies such a big part of Georgia's border with the Black Sea. So part of it is keeping these neighbors at bay down here. And the ones who are below them, right? Iran and Iraq, that's a big part of it. Yeah, exactly. But part of it is economic and geopolitical, and trying to maintain control of this incredibly important Black Sea coast. So, yeah, there's a lot of economic investment involved. Yeah.
Where on the map are the
ones who I was working with are in this city here, but they actually live, there's a lot concentrated here. There's some in Gori from South Ossetia. There's some in the capital. And then there's quite a few just kind of spread out over this whole region. So they really are dispersed kind of all over the country and extremely visible in some ways and invisible in other ways. Yeah.
Are the IDPs mainly from rural regions and villages?
No, that's a really good question.
Or are they from cities?
Yeah, that's a really good question. A lot of the ones from Abkhazia, a lot of them fled from Suchumi, which is kind of the capital city there. And then a lot of them, yeah, were from more rural populations. And the ones from South Ossetia, I guess that's a sort of smaller, more rural. So it's a combination, really. Yeah.
One final question. Yes.
Did you have a translator with you, or do you know Georgian?
Both. Okay. I do know Georgian, but working in this region, they speak Georgian, but they also speak Mingrelian, which is a non-written, it's not a dialect of Georgian, but it's a small language that's related to Georgian. I don't know Mingrelian, so I have Georgians who work with me either translating Mingrelian from Georgian or my Georgian or English into Mingrelian or Russian or whatever. So it's a multilingual population. Yeah, it's a great question, but I do know Georgian.
Well, again, on behalf of our sponsor, WKU Libraries Friends Organization, the WK Libraries Museum, our genial host here at Barnes & Noble, we especially want to thank you, Professor Coates, for coming out all this way from Lexington and telling us about a very little-known part of the world. We've all certainly profited from our time here. We hope you'll, again, join us for our faraway places, and on October 20th, we'll be back here to talk about the Peace Corps Kentuckians who've served abroad by the Wilsons, who are professors emeritus at the University of Kentucky School of Education. And again, thank you and good evening.
Thank you, everyone. Yeah.